Richard Rhodes, one of America's most revered historians, tells the haunting, remarkable, and until now largely untold story of the Spanish Civil War through the eyes of the reporters, writers, artists, doctors, and nurses who witnessed it. He does so in his new book, Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. Rhodes, who won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the National Book Award, chronicles the experience, the struggles, and achievements of artists, writers, architects, doctors, educators, politicians, and inventors against the panoramic backdrop of one of the world's most enchanting cities at the height of its splendor and influence, and through some of the most dramatic episodes of its history. Again, the name of the book is Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Rhodes to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What brought you to the Spanish Civil War and writing about it? Because it's fascinating to me of what a cast of characters it has.
Well, that, of course, is always a delight when you come across a time and place in history where there are so many amazing people involved. I was interested in the other end of the spectrum that ends at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, first of all, and I guess the iconic city bombing, firebombing event, the first of its kind, was the bombing of the Basque town of Guernica in April of 1937, the event that spawned Picasso's great painting, Guernica, and was intrigued to see that the bombing itself was carried out as a kind of a test experience by a squadron of German planes that Hitler had loaned to Franco, who was waging war against his own people at that point in time. And it was from that, as I started looking around in terms of the documents and the books and so on, that I really expanded the book into a larger view of aspects of the Spanish Civil War that really have not been written much about, believe it or not.
I want to get to that aspect in a moment. You mentioned Guernica and Picasso's famous painting, and you use a right-hand portion of the painting on the front cover of the book. Did that serve as an inspiration to you?
The painting?
Yes.
Well, yeah. It's curious. When I was an undergraduate in college, I used to take the train down from New Haven to New York. That painting was on display for many years at the Museum of Modern Art. But, I mean, I came from a farm in Missouri, and in a way, my first exposure to modern art was that extraordinary painting. It's 25 feet long and 10 feet high. It's the size of a movie screen, and it was painted, Picasso deliberately painted it in black and white and gray, I think to evoke the feeling for the newsreel films of the day, which were not yet in color. And, of course, he distorts the figures and the perspective in a kind of cubist way. But it's just one of the most powerful paintings ever painted. So I have a long history of being inspired by and fascinated by that particular painting, and maybe that's the kind of prehistory of how I ended up writing about that particular war.
And you could understand how the time of how the war, 1936 to 1939, inspired and haunted so many artists, including Picasso.
Yeah. And, you know, the other aspect of that war, and I think this is a pervasive fact about it, it really was in many ways a run-up for the Second World War. Time magazine in 1937 called it a little world war, and what they meant by that is not only were the Spanish people fighting each other, I mean, it was a civil war between the liberal side of the political world in Spain and the fascist side. The generals who in Spain very often staged coup d'etat were trying to do that again with General Francisco Franco in the lead. they were using mercenaries from North Africa to fight against their own people. And I mean, they managed to kill between the two sides about 500,000 people in the course of the war in a country of only 20 million people. So a huge percentage of the population. And civil wars are particularly brutal wars, as we know from our own civil war. So, but at the same time, Franco was backed by both fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. And whenever he seemed to be faltering, they would resupply him with planes and tanks and artillery, and in the case of Italy, about 100,000 soldiers in the course of the war. So he really couldn't lose, and that was the tragedy of the war. None of the European or American democracies stepped in on the side of the Spanish Republic. They were, I guess, they didn't want to get involved. They hoped that it wouldn't lead to a Second World War in Europe, and of course it did. But we didn't help the people who might have forestalled a Second World War. The people who did help, and the people I write about, were volunteers, Americans, British, German, French, whoever really, and I think this is not a cliche in this case, whoever loved liberty, volunteered and went over there and fought and died for the Spanish Republic. And at the same time, the Germans were bringing in their newest planes, newest tanks. They were testing out techniques for destroying entire cities with firebombing. That's what the bombing of Guernica was about. They deliberately set out to see if they could burn down an entire city of 6,000 people from the air. And ironically, the firebombing of Guernica came back to haunt them in the Second World War when the British and we, the United States, firebombed Germany, very much larger scale than, but I mean, it was the same technology that they had pioneered.
Richard Rhodes is our guest this morning. We're talking about his new book, Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. You talk about the progress during this time, and the war really spurred breakthroughs in military and medical technology, new aircraft, new weapons, new tactics, new strategy, and as you said, in many cases, volunteers responsible for this.
I was, let's just say first, one of the ironies of war is that although lots of people are killed, there are often medical breakthroughs and medical improvements during war just out of sheer necessity. And in the case of the Spanish World War, much as the machinery that was tested during that war ended up being the equipage of the Second World War, so also doctors trying to solve particular problems. Let's just take perhaps the most amazing example. There had been no use of stored blood during the First World War. The technology for preserving blood was only developed in around 1915 at the Rockefeller Institute in New York. So it just didn't get dispersed during the First World War. They instead, when they did have blood transfusion, typically would do it arm to arm between a volunteer and someone who needed blood. And there were losses accordingly. I think 60% of the deaths in the First World War were from disease or wounds that weren't adequately treated because the wound technologies weren't available yet. But between the two world wars, stored blood transfusion was developed in the Soviet Union, which is such a huge country, was such a huge country, that they needed a way to transport blood across 11 time zones. That's how big the Soviet Union was. And so they developed a method for treating the blood with sodium citrate to prevent it from clotting, and then storing it in the refrigerator, kind of like milk, and shipping it out to wherever it was needed to be used for people in car accidents and industrial accidents and so forth. So the technology had been devised, but it hadn't yet been applied to war. So when the Spanish War came along, doctors were deeply concerned with the fact that their wounded, because the hospitals were pretty far behind the lines, their wounded were bleeding out as they were transported across Spain's terrible roads from the front lines back to the rear hospitals. So they started developing a system. In one case, a doctor had 1,000 donors, all pretty much all women, in Madrid, who would come in once a month and donate a pint of blood and would be rewarded often simply with a meal because they were starving in most of these cities where they couldn't get to their food supply because of Franco's armies and various embargoes by the democracies of Europe. So they developed a method for collecting blood from donors, storing it in refrigerated containers, and then in the first instance using a fish delivery truck, which was refrigerated, and a whole fleet of those. They'd take the blood up to the front lines and transfuse the wounded soldiers and then take them back to the rear hospitals and save their lives accordingly. This is the kind of, and then when the Second World War came along, of course, this technology was in place, had been tested and tried out, and it was immediately put to use, saving the lives of our men and the British soldiers and throughout Europe as well. I have a photograph, I wasn't able to get the rights to use it in the book, that says everything about what pioneering technology this was. It's a photograph of a table with lots of containers of stored blood on it, ready to be put into the truck and delivered. But instead of what you would expect, you know, a plastic bottle as we use today, or even a glass bottle in hospitals as used to be used, the containers are sterilized wine bottles and milk bottles. They didn't even yet have a standardized container. They were delivering the blood to the front line, the wine too, in these improvised containers.
You write beautifully in the book, if destructive technology amplifies violence, constructive technology amplifies compassion, and the lessons of technology are universal. You alluded to something a moment ago, and I want to get back to it, which is that so many aspects of the story that you tell in this book, through the eyes of the reporters and the writers and the artists and the doctors and the nurses who witnessed it, has been lost and has not been told. And I'm curious as to why you believe that has been the case over these decades.
Well, let's take one example, one of the most amazing examples. I went to a library at New York University, the Tamament Library, which has a large collection of documents related to the Spanish Civil War, and found entire book-length memoirs written by, for example, a New York surgeon named Edward Barsky, who went over to Spain early in the war and helped the Spanish Republic organize its hospitals. By the end of the war, he was the overall charge of some 22 hospitals for the many international volunteers. Some 40,000 people volunteered to help the Spanish Republic fight Franco and his mercenaries during the war. And Dr. Barsky was in overall charge of all of those hospitals. Well, Barsky, when he got back to the United States in 1939, wrote a beautiful memoir with the help of a woman journalist he hired. I found that memoir sitting in typescript, untouched for so long that the pages of paper had turned so brown that they were too dark to scan. We had to photograph them and then have someone actually type out the text into the computer. And what happened? Well, the Spanish Civil War ended in April of 1939. The Second World War began with the German invasion of Poland in September of 1939. And I think one has to say that the Second World War simply swamped this small regional little world war, and people's attention turned, of course, to the much larger scale. I mean, 55 million people were killed in the Second World War. And of course, compared to 500,000, that's just simply buries that other number. So Barsky's manuscript sat on the shelf. And then after the war, because so many of the volunteers were communists, so a lot of people who were of liberal political persuasion thought that the Communist Party in America and elsewhere was the right place to go during the 1930s. Later, typically, were disillusioned when they realized that it was backed by Stalin and his dictatorial ways. So Barsky was a communist, and after the Second World War, he was called up by the notorious House Un-American Activities Committee, and because he refused to give them the names of some of the people he was working with, they threw him in federal prison for 6 months, and then his medical license was lifted for another 6 months. Eventually, he went back to medical practice and continued his life. But his book fell afoul of the political currents of the post-war years. I was able then to turn to this wonderful book manuscript and draw on it for his experiences. He's one of the major characters in the book. So there were lots of manuscripts like that lying about that had simply been lost.
Meanwhile, George Orwell also wrote a memoir of that time in the war in homage to Catalonia, and writes, "This war in which I played so ineffectual a part has left me with memories that are mostly evil, and yet I do not wish that I had missed it." And I assume that you fully understand that after emerging yourself into this.
Well, somewhere along the way, he also says, because the Spanish people were so wonderful, he was just stunned by their graciousness and their generosity. I mean, if he, in the course of moving around Spain, encountered a Spanish family in a little house somewhere, they would offer up their own dinner. It was, he just saw again and again what wonderful people the Spanish were. So in the midst of all the ugliness of war, and of course it was ugly, and Orwell was shot through the throat in the course of, unfortunately, sticking his head up behind it from a trench in the front lines one day. Orwell was quite tall, and he made the mistake of exposing himself and took a bullet through the throat that, luckily for him, didn't penetrate any major blood vessels, even though the throat is not a very large part of the body. It did nick his vocal cords, and he lost his voice for about 6 months, at which point he figured it was about time to go home. By then, he'd been through a year in the trenches and dealing with lice and dirty conditions and all that, and had run out of money, and he was ready to write his book. But, you know, even his book, even Homage to Catalonia, was not published until the early 1950s. It just disappeared from view as well. So the Second World War kind of overshadowed the Spanish War, despite the irony that so much of what was developed for good and for ill during the Spanish War served then for good purposes in the Second World War, or bad purposes, as the case may be.
Richard Rhodes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. We're talking with him about his new book, Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. We also not only hear about memoir, but novels as well. Ernest Hemingway's From Whom the Bell Tolls, you point out, takes place in 1937 and was directly inspired by his on-the-ground reporting for the North American Newspaper Alliance during the war.
Yes, he was over in Spain for two periods of about 3 months each, right after the first of the year 1937, and then again in 1938. One of the curious things about his time in Spain is that he seems never to have been prepared to acknowledge that the Republic was losing. He would be talking about, oh, well, they'll do this and they'll be able to do that, and then they'll get rid of Franco eventually. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. I think at one point it was Orwell who said, one of the lessons we learned from the Spanish Civil War is that the good guys don't always win. But Hemingway on the ground in Spain is quite a wonderful story. It's been told in various ways. I was able to look at it. You know, one of the characters I discovered not much written about was this wonderful British nurse whose name was Patience Darton, who was tall and blue-eyed and very pretty, lovely and personality dominant and strong, who would go into these really decrepit, terrible Spanish hospitals where the nurses were almost always nuns, and because of their particular reticence about men, when soldiers came in dirty and wounded, would simply put them on a bed, would not be able to disrobe them and clean them up. So when patients and her fellow English nurses arrived, they would sweep through one of these old dirty hospitals and just clean the place from top to bottom. I mean, she found one hospital where for at least 100 years they'd been throwing severed limbs and old dirty bandages out one particular set of windows into the back courtyard. She said when you opened a window, the flies buzzing up would be an absolute black cloud. She enlisted all the young medical interns and the local women, and they just cleaned all these places up. Well, patients describes arriving in Spain in one particular town and bumping up into Ernest Hemingway and an English writer, and they liked pretty girls. They invited her to dinner immediately, and she, in her notes, was shocked that they were actually interested in her opinion. They had a good evening together. So one of the pleasures of writing this kind of history is that these people all kind of bump into each other along the way, and often interconnect in interesting ways. Patients met and treated and fell in love with a wounded German anti-Nazi Jew who was part of the International Brigade, with this wonderful force of men from Europe and from the United States who fought for the Republic. She and her lover, Robert, eventually married and had some wonderful times together when they went off on leave. But then inevitably Robert was killed late in the war. He stepped on a landmine. And she just about went crazy. And the doctor she was working with, who was a wise man, said, "Look, I know the cure for you." And he took her up to the front lines, and they dodged bullets and helped the wounded for a while, which seems to have saved patients' sanity. So here is a woman who would be worthy of a motion picture all by herself, who's just one of the characters that I was able to come across and write about in this book.
Hers is a fascinating story because, as you write about in the book, she basically came to notice from the doctor because she slapped a cook who wasn't doing his job, and also in this process was really, while, as you say, was not an invention of the Spanish Civil War, that was really advancing what we know as triage today.
Yes, the doctors were faced with the problem of an overwhelming number of casualties, and they had to decide in what order to treat them. And given the limited amount of medical supplies and the limited amount of doctors and nurses, they devised what we now know as triage, the system for sorting the casualties that's still in use today, not quite the same way it's organized, but the idea that when you have an overwhelming disaster, you have to prioritize whom you treat first is exactly something that, again, was invented during the Spanish Civil War. In their case, the problem was they had to decide what to do with men who were, given the medical qualities of the day, mortally wounded, as opposed to those who were, let's say, lightly wounded. So their system basically was treat those who could be treated with the immediate care. I mean, someone whose airway was obstructed, someone who was bleeding profusely and would bleed out if you didn't stop the bleeding, would get immediate priority. But then the next category would be the lightly wounded. And those who were so severely wounded that they were probably going to die anyway would be treated with pain relief and set aside. The one doctor who was involved in developing this method tells this wonderful story of going up to see the Russian general who was in charge of this particular battalion of the Spanish Republic's army. to tell him what they were doing. And the general, who had not thought through the necessities, was so infuriated that he threatened to send all the doctors up to the front lines without weapons if they continued to be so savage in their treatment of the men who were mortally ill and mortally wounded. But they did install this system, and it's another example of something that was then made available for use in the Second World War. Another example is the development of surgical techniques to treat severe wounds and severe fractures. This was before the time of antibiotics. The first antibiotic, which was sulfa, was only introduced in 1937, which would have been the middle of the Spanish War, but it really didn't make it into the war until near the very end. So they had to deal with infection at a level that we've forgotten used to exist. And the methods they devised, they put together into a surgical manual, which was translated into English and directly distributed among the medical corps of the British and American armies in the Second World War. So weapons of new kinds, new methods of bombing, new methods of killing, but also new methods of saving lives.
It is a fascinating account. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book, and it is certainly great tragedy, but also great comedy in this as well.
There is, yes, there is.
The book is Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Richard Rhodes, a great honor to speak with you. I thank you so much for spending time with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, the title of the book is Hell and Good Company, The Spanish Civil War and the World It Made. Richard Rhodes is the author. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.